This episode of Design by Architectural Record is sponsored by Vitro Architectural Glass. Solarban R77 Glass by Vitro Architectural Glass reveals new design possibilities with its unique neutral reflective aesthetic. Thanks to its balanced, reflective visual quality, Solarban R77 Glass is ideal for realizing facade and curtain wall designs intended to capture visual character of the sky and ambient environment. Discover the possibilities with Solarban R77 Glass at vitroglazing.com/SBR77. That's vitroglazing.com/SBR77. And this episode is sponsored by Bilco. The Bilco company manufactures a complete line of fire and life safety products for commercial building applications. Bilco's automatic smoke vents protect property and aid firefighters in bringing a fire under control by removing smoke, heat, and gases from a burning building. This ensures better visibility, evacuation time, and protection against fire spread, as well as reduces the risk of smoke inhalation and structural damage. The product features a thermal latch positive hold release mechanism that ensures reliable vent operation when a fire occurs and is engineered with gas spring operators to open covers in snow and windy conditions. Automatic smoke vents are fully insulated and gasketed for weather tightness and constructed with corrosion-resistant materials to provide many years of trouble-free, dependable service. For more information on Bilco's complete line of products, please visit bilco.com, and there you can find BIM models, CAD details, three-part specifications, all found on their website. Their highly trained sales representatives are also always there to help provide technical support. Again, that's bilco.com, B-I-L-C-O.com. Enjoy the show.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Designed, a podcast by Architectural Record. We appreciate you listening, and once finished, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast, rate us, and leave a comment. If you'd like to learn more about design and see all the other great content that Architectural Record has to offer, please visit architecturalrecord.com for more information. Enjoy the show, and have a wonderful day.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Designed by Architectural Record. I am your host, Aaron Prinz. Of course, I just want to thank all of you out there for listening to the podcast and sharing it with your friends. It really means so much. Of course, be sure to check out architecturalrecord.com. And while you're there, pick up a copy of the magazine. It has everything you need to keep up to date with the world of architecture. And follow the podcast on Instagram at designed.podcast for everything we have coming up, because we got some doozies, folks. This week's episode is no different. We have principal of Diamond Schmidt, Gary McCluskey, and president and CEO of the New York Philharmonic, Deborah Borda. And they're here to talk about the renovation of David Geffen Hall at Lincoln Center in New York City. Really, really interesting conversation. We have the perspective of kind of a very high-profile client, as well as the architect and how they respond to the needs and the wants. And it's just so much to take away from this episode. I really enjoyed it. They're both kind of, the way they feed off each other is really, really wonderful. So I don't want to delay it too much, but sit back, relax, enjoy. Here we go with Gary McCluskey and Deborah Borda. Deborah, we're going to start with you, because my understanding is that this renovation, from what I've read, started a long, long time ago, and it's sort of been delayed and delayed, and they're getting funding together, they're not getting funding together. So I wanted to start with, you know, it's always an interesting sort of perspective to have the client, so to speak, on these sort of calls, because architects can go into their vision and their story for endless amount of hours. But I want to kind of understand, can you give us a little bit of the backstory, the project goals, the expectations? And we're opening here in October, so we're a few months away, but how has it been so far?
Well, let's do the real backstory, okay?
Well, let's hear the real story. This is what we want. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah. Okay.
So let's go way back to when the hall was opened in 1962. In those days, it was called Philharmonic Hall. And as you know, it was a major urban redevelopment project by none other than Robert Moses, to be the greatest Athenaeum for the arts in the world. And in fact, it is the most remarkable collection of artistic constituents, still to this day, any place in the world. The boards of Lincoln Center and the New York Philharmonic worked to build a new hall. You might ask, why did the New York Philharmonic leave Carnegie Hall? Well, it was falling apart at the time. It was about to be condemned. It didn't have air conditioning. So imagine that, a New York summer. And I think the heating didn't work all the time either. So here was this shining city on the hill that the Philharmonic wanted to be a part of. As the hall was designed, and it had a wonderful architect, his name was Max Abramovitz, he and the acoustician basically planned for a hall. It would have about 2,200 seats. But at that time in the 60s, the board of both organizations, you can't blame the New York Philharmonic or the Lincoln Center board alone, they decided in their wisdom that it was important that the new Philharmonic Hall be exactly the size that Carnegie Hall was. Carnegie Hall has 2,800 seats, and the new Philharmonic Hall was only have 2,200. So they literally, about six months to 8 months before the hall opened, told the architect and the acoustician, we're putting in another 600 seats. So I think the analogy that probably works best for this is, say you have a size 8 foot, and you are told you are going to wear a size 6 shoe. It just doesn't work. And that's what happened. And so through the years, although the hall has had so many really beautiful aspects to it, the original Abramovitz designs, if you look at these pictures, are simply stunning. It never worked acoustically. There was a try in the 70s.
I mean, you're just playing music, Deborah. Is it really that, like, the acoustics, is that really a big thing? I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah. The acoustics are a big thing. If you go to a concert, hey, there are two problems. If you go to a concert and A, you can barely hear the orchestra, it sounds sort of dead, and you can't see them. Because, like, if you were behind row M, you couldn't see the orchestra. It was like being in two different rooms. It had an old-fashioned proscenium stage. It just didn't work. Everybody knew it. I mean, Lenny Bernstein said it from the beginning. I think George Sell said the best thing to do is to burn the hall down and start again. I mean, it was controversial from the beginning. So there was an attempt in the mid-70s to renovate it, and that's when it became Avery Fisher Hall. Avery Fisher was a great lover of music. I knew him well, really a fantastic man, and he wanted the Philharmonic to have a great home. And they did improve the sound, but unfortunately, it became a sort of drab, very monochromatic, corporate kind of presence. And the sound wasn't as bad as people said, but the whole psychoacoustics of going to a concert, it didn't work. So fast forward to when I first worked at the Philharmonic in the 90s, when I was the head of the Philharmonic. And I just knew this was a problem. I'm a New Yorker. I'm a musician. So we worked very hard with our board and with the Lincoln Center board to convince both groups that it was time to make a major change in the hall. I started that project in 1995. And now this is the complete.
I was seven. So to put it in perspective.
I left out. I was not seven. I was not even 20. I left in frustration in the year, actually 1999, because Frank Gehry and the Los Angeles Philharmonic came calling, and they were building what looked to me like the single most beautiful concert hall I could imagine. They got on a plane and they sent Frank out to see me, and I fell in love with Frank, and I made a big decision to load up my covered wagon and move out west, and I stayed there for 17 years. But we built the hall. There were also problems with that hall. That had also been a long odyssey of building. So here we are, 2022 in October, and the hall is going to open. It is restored to its original size. But in addition to that, it's wonderful, actually, that we're doing it now, because orchestras and what we do with orchestras and how we present music and how we think about music has changed so much in the 21st century. So this hall, rather, although it is built as a orchestra hall, an orchestra of the 21st century doesn't just sit there and play Mozart and Beethoven. It puts on all sorts of other events. It uses amplified sound. It plays with, it gives concerts where we accompany movies. We do, you know, we'll do world music. We do all sorts of things. And this hall is built to do it. So that is a very long-winded answer.
No, that is
the final thing
perfect.
I'm going to put in.
Yeah.
Don't forget about psychoacoustics. I used to call the color of the seats in David Geffen Hall Maird Brown. That's what it looked like. And well, Gary will talk a little bit later, I'm sure, about the remarkable color and wood and vibrancy we've brought both to the inside of the hall, or Gary has brought to the inside of the hall, and also the vivification of the lobbies.
So, Gary, I want to sort of change gears here. That's a wonderful sort of backstory to have how we got here. But then there's also the architect side of things. So can you walk us through the design process or the redesign process of that, of the hall, and kind of take us through, if you were to walk our audience, you know, from Lincoln Center into the hall, what would that experience be like? Because I feel like there are certain buildings, especially in New York City. And I mean, Lincoln Center to me sounds like a terrifying, if someone's like, hey, you want to redesign part of Lincoln Center? I'd be like, no. But so can you take us through that whole sort of design process, dealing with, you know, the city, the pressure of making sure you get it right. Just go into it if you can.
Yeah, the pressure of dealing with Deborah Borda.
If this is it, then sign me up, Deborah.
No. Exactly. As you can imagine, Aaron, that was all positive. And maybe I'll come at it a couple of different ways. One way, though, and to pick up the trail of the story, as Deborah was doing, about the process of kind of getting to where we are now, 6 months away from it being reopened, there are kind of a couple of really key pieces to that. So we started actually on a version of this in about 2015. So intervening years, the entire renovation and kind of reimagination of the Lincoln Center campus has happened. So Lincoln Center has gotten, they've figured out many ways in which they're improving the character of the campus. And just touching on some of the themes Deborah has mentioned of making it much more engaged with the contemporary city, 21st century city. So all that is happening within the campus. The Philharmonic project, David Geffen Hall, it's kind of the final piece in that whole story of reimagining campus. And from the outset, when we joined the story in about 2015, 2016, the first version of what we looked at was Deborah and her team in Lincoln Center said, how do we go about doing all the things? Like, instead of a small fix, we really need to take this on much more comprehensively. And that we did a version of that design. And the reason why I mention it is that time, scheduling and time, and the Philharmonic as an active, vibrant, live concert, you know, performing company in the city is so important to this, because some of the first versions we had, the extent of work that was required turned out was going to take too long. It was going to be upwards of 3 years. And Deborah and her board said, we need to really think about this and think about ways that we can do it that are really focused on the most important aspects of the project. And so when we came at it again and really conceived of a master plan for the project, it was focused on the auditorium and it was focused on getting that sound. You at the beginning, you were kind of making that comment, really, it sounds so important for an orchestra.
And that's really zeroed in on that. That's a half, like a tongue-in-cheek sort of comment. I don't want that.
No, that's why I appreciate it, because it really was. That was number one. And so when we refocused on the project, two things Deborah was saying was, we need the sound to be amazing. That needs to be just kind of a given that we'll start with. We also need it to be the project to be able to be built. Because basically we're rebuilding the concert hall. We need to be able to build it within 2 years maximum. And so when we came back looking at master planning the project, how could we get a great acoustic? We're working with Paul Scarborough from Acoustics. The acousticians involved ourselves, Deborah and her team, Lincoln Center. And we really started from that stage. And so a couple of the themes that she's mentioned, and I'm going to sort of start from the inside. That stage and getting people closer to it, that was the spark of how to improve the acoustics, was have the audience be closer. So when we reconceived of the auditorium, one of the first things we were imagining was tearing down that proscenium so that the orchestra would not be in a separate space, that the orchestra and the audience would be together. And so we really reconceived the space by pulling the stage, the performance space, 25 feet out into the audience and wrapping the audience all the way around, getting rid of proscenium. So together, orchestra and audience are in one space. And that, the kind of the primacy of that connection between the audience, being able to hear, being able to see, being closer, being more connected. Those were at the core of the project, how we were going to make this a much better space. Deborah mentioned it, but it's worth reinforcing. One of that second key point was it has to be the right size. So instead of 2,700-2,800 in the old hall, 2,200 was identified by the acousticians of within the volume that we could carve in that space. It's an existing building. We had to work with that. There's an amazing exterior to the building. We all said, let's keep that. I mean, some things are really working here. Lincoln Center as a campus is amazing. Well, how much space can we carve out? And so Paul and his team really said volume, which is so important to the amount of music. He identified the 2,200. That goes back to Deborah and her team. They say, from a business point of view, we can make that work. It's so important. The second, third set of themes Deborah's also mentioned, though, is so amazing acoustic, but 21st century. We're also planning to make this a great space for the next 50 years. for the new kinds of composition that are happening now, and anticipating in any way that we can the ways in which composers of the future will think about this space. So a couple of easy ways to imagine that infrastructure is we have this space. Every year, the Philharmonic, for example, does, say, might do West Side Story. So, you know, playing the Philharmonic, playing to a projection, to a movie projection. So building in the infrastructure so that is in the space. We can automatically do that. One of the things in wrapping audience all the way around the orchestra as well meant that if they want to do a choral work, well, then that space behind the orchestra is easily converted into the space that the choir will be. So they're no longer having to jam an orchestra and a 100-person choir onto the stage. Just many examples. They stage works. They might do chamber opera. They might do smaller productions. So the flexibility of that stage that we've now moved out into the audience and wrapped it around the audience. Now we can change the size of it, make it smaller, make it larger, add choir, add stage, add projection. And even to the extent, Deborah and the Philharmonic have just announced their season for next year. And the number of new compositions woven into the amazing work that they do for the, you know, of the kind of the canon of orchestra music, the new compositions that want to incorporate pre-recorded sound so that we can also have amplified sound and then completely natural music that the Philharmonic makes, those can be blended together. So all of these kind of components of presentation of sound, yes, but now sound and being visually close to the performance, and now sound and performance, and whether it's projection or amplification or any of the ways that a composer or director might think of presenting music, now this performance space has that infrastructure built in. So when Deborah and her team are thinking of their season, they now know that they can, when a composer comes and asks a question about, can I do projection? Can I do choral works? Can I do interesting things with light? They can do all of that just naturally built in. So it expands the kind of the capability of performance in the space.
Well, I want to take a step back to the putting the stage kind of in the round, because my first introduction to this was I did an interview with Barry Katz, who he's a kind of a legendary comedy manager, if you will. And he used to manage Dane Cook, Dave Chappelle, Louis C.K. Like anyone that's like really famous was eventually at some point managed by him. And he was talking about when Dane Cook played Madison Square Garden, and he said we could do it at, you know, proscenium style seating, but he was saying he was an animated enough performer, he thought he could take on the round where he jumps from one side of the stage to the other, and he can work kind of all angles. Now, an orchestra is not that type of performance, so I don't even really know if there's a question here, but can we kind of talk about the theater in the round fit with this?
Yeah, because some of the greatest contemporary halls in the world have used, and I love the name. We called it when I lived in California, vineyard seating, and you can call it surround seating. Vineyard has a nice tang to it. Maybe people are up there drinking.
Very California of you.
But yeah, but what it does is, first of all, the first person who conceived of the way you could actually fix the sound in the hall was the music director who actually followed Leonard Bernstein, and that was the great Pierre Boulez. And he experimented. He put the orchestra all over the hall. He had them play in different places. And he identified if you pulled the orchestra out about 25 or 30 feet, as we have done, that was the sweet spot of the hall. But in addition, if you surround the musicians with people, and by the way, this isn't, as I was going to say, in the great Charun Hall in Berlin, the Philharmonie, the audience surrounds, it's vineyard there. I guess I don't know if you call it vineyard in Germany, you know, a beer setting, a beer garden. In Walt Disney Concert Hall, the audience surrounds the orchestra. And what it makes is a very visceral and interactive kind of experience. And that's so important because people today are so hit in their face with all of the technology that we have. You know, if you look at the old Leonard Bernstein Young People's Concerts, which was like a couple of cameras shooting in black and white on a stage, younger people my age, remember those as great, you know, spiritual, intellectual, emotional experiences. You show it to a 10-year-old today, they won't even watch it. So we have to find a way to be more interactive and engage the audience. And that's what I think is so great about the seating, in addition to, as Gary said, that there are all kinds of stage presentations we can do with it and move choruses around. So I think that's a really critical part of the hall.
And maybe just a core, just in case, Aaron, the sound is amazing in those locations. And the I find as you're, as a, for example, you know, there's a soloist is preparing because of their moment in the music is coming. That aspect of it, when you're visually that close, you those cues of something getting ready, something having finished, a sort of the combination of work, the brass or have a kind of a moment in the music and all of them are together. You get those strong visual connections, seeing those in the round, like music does work in the round because again, it's sound. Yes, there's a visual component to it, but you're really enjoying the performers and you're able to kind of have that sort of stronger connection to the activity of their performance as well.
Deborah mentioned, imagine how much fun it is, Gary, if you're sitting back there and the first trombone makes a mistake and you see how ticked off the music director gets them. You see everything. It's amazing. You can read the trumpet part.
And Deborah's mentioned that visual quality, Aaron. I think, you know, with our headphones at home, we can hear amazing music. What's the difference about attending a concert? The room itself is the musical instrument. Yes, all of the instruments in the orchestra are musical instruments as well, but the room itself is what is blending that music and creating that symphonic sound. And just to say, that's the amazing thing about, for architects, working on a space for music, you're creating architecture, so the aesthetic character of that, but it is also, you are creating a musical instrument that blends the winds, the woodwinds, the brass, it blends all of that together and creates that sound that we hear together. So it's an amazing aspect of design and that you're creating an environment, you're creating experience, you're also with the acoustician and all the other collaborators of this space, you're helping to kind of create the sound. And so that aspect of facilitating the emotions of the music that's going to come from the orchestra and in this space, the space is going to create the sound. And then again, we as the audience, we are critical to the performer as well, performers and the audience. Do you know what I mean? The way in which all of this goes together to make this event, I think the in the round is just such a direct way to make that connection aspect, the social aspect, the spatial aspect, that the music may be the same as when you have headphones on, but that is just an individual experience. The collective aspect of the orchestra and the audience together in a room. That's what's amazing about being together in a concert hall. And I think that's why this form, whether you vineyard, surround, all the different descriptions of it, that's why I think it is so relevant today and why audiences are connecting to it so strongly.
And you know, there's another aspect to this, Gary, which we should mention, which is installed on the stage and it's push button, these can be deployed in a minute, are a series of risers so that when you are sitting in the audience, you can actually, and our great principal clarinet, Anthony McGill, plays that fantastic Gershwin solo, you can actually see him in addition to hearing him. And again, that physical connection, that visual connection, in addition to the audio one, is so important. And so not only can you, you know, if you sat in the old days in the old hall, what you looked at were the ankles of the cello and violin section. And although they have wonderful ankles, I mean, it's, you know, you don't want to see everybody's shoes and socks, and that's what you saw. And this way you can see people throughout. And it's so fun. We have such a loyal Philharmonic following. You know, I get to meet our donors at different events. And I'm always sort of touched because people follow individual musicians. And sometimes they'll tell me, oh, we made up stories about this one's dating that one. And this one got angry at that one. It's this whole sort of, it brings them into our family even closer.
Well, on that note of, you know, such a loyal following, you have a cultural center that has been there for 60 years. Someone that's been attending since they were a little kid and they walk into a newly renovated theater, is there a part, like we live in this nostalgia culture, right? Is there a part when someone walks in and they're like, yeah, but it was something about the jagged roof or the angle, you know what I mean? That really like,
I cannot imagine any nostalgia for the old Avery Fisher Hall. I don't think anybody's going, oh, I miss those old Merritt Brown seats. Oh, I miss not being able to see the orchestra. Oh, I miss not being able to hear the basses. I don't think so.
I don't think that aspect. That aspect, Deborah, I don't think so, Aaron. The space itself, that 70s version, we've not kind of not experienced that. We're working on the project now for, you know, sort of 5 or 6 years. But from the outset of the project, the travertine columns, that sort of signature iconic image of Geffen Hall, you know, the arches of the Met, travertine as well, David Koch, the travertine, though that aspect of it clearly, you know, has a huge connection, iconic in the city, in the country, in the world. And that was an interesting point as well, because as we came to working on the space, and we were talking a lot here about the performance space and how important that was for music, but the aesthetic of that, I think there were aspects of that mid-century modern. There's a real optimism, I think, that's associated. I certainly associate with that mid-century modern kind of vibe that we associate with Lincoln Center. And we certainly came to the interior wanting to have some aspect of that as well. We felt like we were, it was important. Deborah mentioned Max Abramovich, the and you know, it was a whole team that worked on Lincoln Center, but Abramovich and Philharmonic Hall, and thinking of kind of collaborating in some ways in the spirit of that time. So we're not making it like it would look in 1962, but just being, you know, respectful and wherever we could, maybe take some cues from that. So that there's some, you know, I'm going to get into too much detail, but there's tapering of those slender columns, which, you know, I could show you in the design ways in which we were aware of that. It's not by any means, you know, a mirror or a copy, but certainly ways in which we were inspired by that. But then there were other ways where I think we were really in direct contrast, Aaron. So when we came to start to talking about the materials of the room with Deborah and her team, the idea of bringing wood, that this, she's mentioned psychoacoustic, the idea that somehow, because instruments on the stage, so many of them have that wood, there's a coloration to it, obviously it was super important to the sound they make, but that somehow in our minds, being in a wood-lined space helps kind of carry that sense of music, of sound to the entire space. So one of the things we started talking on very early with the Philharmonic was using wood as the primary material for wrapping the stage. It became into the shaping of it. We thought of musical instruments when we curved the sides of the balconies in ways that are, again, I think, allude to the kind of the character of musical instruments. But then many things were also counterpoints. So we have a mesh ceiling above the audience, which will catch and reflect light in kind of an effervescent way. And we have a light fixture, a contemporary version of a chandelier above the musicians themselves. And it's completely motorized, and well, we call it fireflies because it has a kind of a flickering quality. And I think that idea of the ephemeral thing that somehow has a connection with music, I think, is another way in which the design is reinforcing this idea of being together in a space. But it's also because we have the technology is completely programmable. So there will, we haven't worked on it yet, but just starting now with the Philharmonic to work on a sort of a signature movement of these lights, as you might imagine, very much inspired by the light fixture that the Met has. When that chandelier rises up out of the space, it signals that a performance is about to begin. We're making that much more connected to the musicians themselves, where we're imagining as audience enters the hall, there may be some very sort of slight movement of that. But then as that moment of anticipation, musicians are on stage, conductors about to arrive, that through the use of that light fixture, we'll be able to reinforce that sense of anticipation of the music.
And you know, one point that Gary makes that's terrific, that maybe, which is, while we have really reimagined the inside of the hall, the outside of the hall, as he said, it's classic mid-century modern. It's iconic. And my contention is this, that 50 years and 100 years from now, we will actually be heroes or sheroes because we didn't change the outside. We did not destroy that. We kept the look and we kept the actual facade and the footprint of Lincoln Center. And I think that act of respect for the past and the future is just so, so important.
Well, and you guys are setting me up here perfect. You're just like reading my mind on what's coming next. But you have Todd Williams and Billy Chen doing the public spaces of the hall. And those working with them, Gary, I can only imagine what that was like. I did an hour-long podcast with them, and I felt like it was just like a roller coaster of a husband and wife going back and forth on one another. But there's a big focus on bringing a public presence to the theater. Can we kind of go into what that entails and just what can people expect from, not maybe if they're not in the hall, but if they're outside, what can they expect?
I'll let Gary talk about it, but let me give you the philosophy that we charge them with. And then Gary can tell you, I mean, some of the really, some stunning features of the hall. Today, it's not enough to say, we put an ad in the newspaper and you should join us. Today, we have to find a way to invite people in, to convince them that it is a thrilling, and in some ways can be a life-changing kind of experience to hear live music. Well, if you have very sort of dead or non-transparent lobbies, that's not going to work. And one of the things that, as we talked with Gary and when we went to Billy and Todd, we charged them with, was to bring life and vibrancy to the lobbies. First of all, they were able to double the lobby space that was available, and Gary will talk about that, but we've added two remarkable new performing areas. And one thing I'll talk about, and then I'm going to let Gary go and tell you how it all happened, is at the end of the new lobby, which is twice as big as the old lobby, there is a 50-foot video wall. It's called the digital wall, digital stage. And on that, we can live stream concerts. So we will be able to live stream, say you arrive late, you can watch the concert. But our thought is bigger than that. Say you don't know if you want to buy a ticket or you can't afford a ticket. You are welcomed into the lobby because these concerts are going to be, by the Philharmonic, will be live streamed. So it's our way of saying, New York, this is your home for music. Please come in and join us. Gary, you can tell about some of the many other different things that have been accomplished.
Well, so just to pick up on that space right there, Aaron, because that's going to be, I think, a pretty amazing space as well. The idea that someone's used the phrase that the Philharmonic is sort of breaking down the walls of the concert hall, you know, as in addition to wrapping the audience around the performers, they're also breaking down the wall through the sort of live streaming, absolutely the entire performance. As it is happening in a separate space and in a separate, obviously, much more open space. It's right at plaza level. There's the history connection as well as Philharmonic, David Geffen Hall, was always the lobby space that was the most open of all the spaces in Lincoln Center. And so they've taken that theme as well and expanded it so that there will be restaurant as well as informal food throughout the lobby space. You can imagine, this is you sitting in a comfortable chair with cafe, with champagne, watching performance in a very informal way. How it all came about was observing, and this again goes back to that Abramovitz building. Originally, there were these large Raker columns, which are supporting the auditorium above us at ground floor level. They were a real architectural feature, and all of that was open, was restaurant in 1962. Over time, box office filled all of that in. So when we came to the project in 2015, 2016, sort of, one of the first ideas was, can we eliminate box office? And Philharmonic and Lincoln Center said, yeah, it's no longer a bank teller kind of relationship with our audience. We want to have something much more direct. So a really engaged space, very informal, at the corner, very visible from Broadway. So, you know, basically box office transformed to be not walls, not windows, basically a person connecting with you in that corner space. But by moving those two things to the outside edge, that's what created the ability for this 50-foot screen and the ability to have essentially informal performance at time of the Philharmonic being, but all afternoon as well, all day. Like the 16-hour lobby, this lobby will be open for the opportunity to come and chat about tickets, but also just open food and beverage, cafe, the video monitor, and when not the performance of the Philharmonic, there will also be programming. So artistic programming on an annual year, there will be a composition in light and sound created for the space and other ways in which it will be kind of a lively presence throughout the day. That idea of opening up and extending the lobbies to the outside, to the plaza, I think it was always built into what Philharmonic and Lincoln Center wanted to do with the new project. I think it only came into greater focus over the last 2 years through the pandemic, through the work the Lincoln Center did in informal ways to open up their campus to the community. This, they're really finding now, they've built the infrastructure, whether it's through the video screen. There's another amazing space on the corner that, Deborah, maybe you start by talking about that, the idea of programming an informal performance space, a sidewalk studio, which also is, I think, a clear opportunity for Philharmonic and Lincoln Center to make much more outreach to the community.
Here's the story of what we call the sidewalk studio. At the corner, if you're a New Yorker, at the corner of 65th and Broadway was one of the corners of David Geffen Hall. And it was the ugliest corner you could imagine. It was a warren of little offices with burlap drapes and what was behind there, besides this little barn of offices, were ushers' uniforms, old programs, and dead tech equipment. So it was a space that it was funny that's what one part of what we showed to the world. So that has been entirely taken out and opened up. And what we discovered when I was there with Henry Timms, who is the president and CEO of Lincoln Center, and I want to say a few things about Lincoln Center in a minute because they have been amazing partners. We opened the drapes and people on the street started waving. You are at street level. You are looking. And people started waving us. We'd wave back. You know, a few people gave the New York salute, but it was great. And this is going to be a performing space for 200 people. You can have recitals, you can have education programs, you could have party, and people can look right in and see what's happening. So there is music happening literally on the street. So we called it the Sidewalk Studio. We're launching a whole bunch of new series, which we've announced in there. You know, some examples are something called New York Phil at noon. Our orchestra is going to play chamber music in the space, but it's going to be you pay what you want. There's no set rate. We have an emerging artist series, that's going to take place. Young, diverse musicians who aren't quite ready to be on the main stage, but they will be in a few years. All sorts of things. I mean, but the connection with the street, I mean, the connection with Broadway and people is just going to be right there. And that's going to be, I think it's going to be one of the most popular between the video wall and Sidewalk Studio. The hall's alive. It's going to be thumping all the time.
I think there's a vibe, Aaron, of turning the hall inside out, like the internal spaces coming to the edge and being part of the life that connects with the city. So these two spaces, which are at plaza level, but if you're calling David Geffen Hall, the main lobby is at a level above. And it was a huge opportunity it's as well to be programmable, to be, of course, great lobby space to do all the things Deborah's mentioned. We've doubled the number of washrooms. We've basically doubled the size of the lobby space. So all of that sense of just being just more relaxed and open at those levels. But everything that we're doing with technical infrastructure to be able to do performance, to be able to do special event, to be able to do sound and light, we've basically rigged the lobby spaces like they were a performance space. So the entire ceiling zone is now set up with equipment so that if you're doing a gala, if you're doing a pre-performance event, if you're doing post-performance event, if you're doing something on Sunday afternoon just for rental, all of those things are now built into the lobby space. But all of that, of course, is, you know, that's amazing. It's going to expand the ability. But what Todd and Billy have brought to this space is just a sense of just a character, I know, glamour, a sense of occasion, color, material, that same effervescent quality that we're creating in the performance space around the musicians with the firefly lights. They're building that through many different fabrics on walls, light fixtures as well in the corners, which will hang and give identity to the lobby spaces. They've really turned it into, again, a space that has a sense of place and a sense of character and a sense of creating the drama. I know the directors call it warming up the house. When you're a performer and you know, when the audience arrives, you don't want the lights, you don't want everything to be like, yeah, shutting people down. You want to be turning them on. And I think what Todd and Billy are doing is from the moment you enter the lobby spaces, the lower levels, as you emerge up to the Grand Promenade, which is the main lobby levels that provide access to the hall, everything about that through the reds, the warmths, the reflectivity off of metals, all of it is about turning your senses on so that as you enter the room, the auditorium does that as well. All of it about the live event. And I think, again, goes back to themes Deborah introduced at the very beginning of the conversation. In the 60s and 70s, there was a different character to that. I'm not sure why, but the opportunity to celebrate being together, I think, is at the core of what Todd and Billy are doing in the public spaces and what we're doing in the performance spaces.
Well, in the 60s, people wore suits and ties and hats. It was just a different time.
Now it's cargo shorts and flip-flops.
Yeah. An interesting side story is the visual motif that Billy and Todd have selected. When they were students in Rome in the spring, this was the idea. In the Pantheon, which is, of course, a historic building, there's an oculus that they opened in the springtime. They pushed thousands of rose petals through on a certain day to welcome the arrival of spring, and they descend through from the dark blue sky down and fall at random on the floor. And that is actually the design for the seats and the tapestries in the hall. It's descending roses and it's vibrant reds and pinks and blues. And based on this vision they had as young people of the roses descending from the oculus of the Pantheon. And it's just stunning. It's so bright and it's just so arresting and so lively.
Now, and a great example, Aaron, of how that's a great link between the concert hall itself, where as Deborah's mentioned, that's the pattern, that's the color and texture of the fabric of the seat. So larger petals, smaller as they come down through the hall. It's also one of the key motifs on the outside of the hall. So Todd and Billy are wrapping the outside of the hall with a felt version of it, even larger scale, so that it can be seen all the way across Broadway. But that color of the rose and the blue, you can imagine looking through those travertine columns, what you have now. And in the evening when that is alive, your eyes are just drawn right into the space. So all of these themes are about how to make the live event as energized as it can be, but also how to use this amazing building on an amazing campus to be part of how we communicate with the audience all day long.
Now, Deborah, I want to just change gears for a couple minutes and then we'll get back to it. But you had mentioned earlier on in the conversation, you had left New York City to go to LA, work with Frank Gehry on the Walt Disney Concert Hall, which is one of probably the most recognizable sort of theater monuments in the country. What, through that whole process, because I would imagine there was a lot of ups and there was a lot of downs, I would imagine, what did you learn from that experience that you wanted to implement in when you started to do this process at Lincoln Center?
A couple of major themes. First of all, I mean, Frank, he was so great. We became such good friends. I loved my work with him. We talked about music. We talked about philosophy. He actually took a hand in helping us to program the opening of the hall. Every Monday night, he and Esa-Pekka Salonen and I would have dinner at a famous Italian restaurant in LA. And we would talk about all sorts of different ideas around music. So his intellectual, visual, and philosophic concept really affected us very, very deeply. So so there were ups and downs, you know, a lot of things go wrong when you're building a hall. We had to delay the opening. In the end, it was also a very long project. It was over many years. We delayed it by 6 months to make sure everything was right. And, you know, he was a great, great partner. One of the things we learned, though, was you have to experiment in certain ways. So one of the things was we tuned the hall, which is very important. And we're going to do that here. So you actually have to have the orchestra rehearse on the stage and the acoustician has to be there. And there are certain elements that they can add to make more resonance or less resonance. For us, it's a sort of pleated wooden panels. And so what we learned sitting with Frank and the acoustician there, Yasu Toyota, was we had to add more reflective surfaces, which we did before the hall opened. I think one of our most important and sort of disaster lessons was that I was very eager to perform, to do what we can now, we'll be able to do at David Geffen Hall, which is to perform a large spectrum of music, including world music and amplified music. John Adams operas are amplified, for example. We didn't take into account, although we were warned by the acoustician, that if you have really great acoustics for natural sound, whenever you show a movie or use amplified sound, it's very muddy. And so it just, you can't hear it. It doesn't sound good. So our first amplified concert was with Keith Jarrett. He went out on stage with his ensemble and he started to play and it was amplified. He got up and he said, "This hall is terrible. I'm not going to do the concert." And he walked off the stage and didn't do the concert. Oh my God. I mean, you can imagine.
All those refunds of those tickets, yeah. That ticket box. Yeah, see, Gehry comes back into effect.
So yeah. We retrofit these banners and these sound absorbers for that. Well, you know, we are in the 21st century. We do have a different vision of what orchestras do as presenting organizations and different things that can give a hall life. So these are installed in the hall ahead of time right now. The kinds of buffers, sound buffers that are literally deployed at the push, you know, press of a button. The other thing I learned from Frank is give things a story, give it vibrancy and warmth. And so when we talked with Billy and Todd about the designs, we said, let's have a story that we can tell, that people like stories. People are human beings. We live in our legends of the past and our visions of the future. And when you give people something that they can hook onto, you know, emotionally, intellectually, I think that was a very powerful lesson I learned from Frank as well.
Awesome. And just to get back to David Geffen Hall here, and you know, it's finished almost 2 years early, which is, I think most of the world right now is dealing with supply chain issues and y'all are thriving. So that's great. But now that it's almost done, you're just a few months away. This has been, Deborah, for you, for 30 years, you're pushing this project. Now that it's almost done, just what do you see as the key successes? What are you most excited to show the public? And just what can people expect as we kind of wrap up here?
I'm superstitious. I'm not going to say till we open. I mean, our announcement of our inaugural season, which shows the spectrum of endeavor, was so well received. So I felt great about that. We haven't heard one note of music in the hall yet. You know, so I'm not going to hex it. I can't do it. Maybe Gary will take a risk. I'm not going to.
Do you know what maybe is worth mentioning though, Deborah, because this is what I was struck by. It was literally about 6 weeks, Aaron, after, you know, that March, April, 2020 pandemic, what's happening? How long is this going to be? It was about 6 weeks into that Philharmonic and Lincoln Center called. They called to keep people together, you know, 9 o'clock Tuesday morning. We all wondered, I wonder what this is going to be about. It's either one of two things, right? Either they're going on hold, which I'm sure you guys were as well. A lot of people went on hold. They didn't go on hold. Double down. We've already set in motion a project that was going to be a quasi-fast-track project. But without getting into the detail of it, we're going to do it in two separate sections. And we're going to be starting construction about now. So they called up and said, we've talked to Turner Construction. We've talked to the folks that are helping with fundraising. You can imagine, Deborah, this is a big moment. And they said, we're going to start now because we're clearly not going to be playing in this space this year. Why don't we take advantage of this opportunity? And that, to me, that was an amazing moment, has clearly shown to have been, you know, extremely prescient, right? It was the right thing to do, but not everybody knew it at the time. And I think Lincoln Center and Philharmonic, with the amount of work that they had done, and we've been part of the planning with them, with the acousticians, with the amount of thinking that had been done, I think gave them the confidence to go fast and start the construction. And as it's turned out, they've raised the money ahead of schedule. As it's turned out, we'll be finishing ahead of schedule. And I think it's in the planning, the careful planning about what's core. Acoustics is core. What's core? Creating this infrastructure for the next 21st year. But what was also core was they were imagining audience outreach. They were imagining new compositions, new audience. And so what else was going on through pandemic? Well, Black Lives Matter, the diversity and equity issues that I think are now super forefront in a lot of people's minds, and the Philharmonic and Lincoln Center, where they're ready to say, we've created infrastructure that we can now use to be able to become this new organization, this new arts group with this new space to perform that we all want to kind of get to. And I think that's what I found most remarkable about this process, because you can imagine, this is not a small project, not a small organization, but that they were able to move so quickly and with such smarts to be able to make the project happen. And now you see in the programming that they're going to be doing next year, work that Deborah and Philharmonic did in outreach to communities all through the pandemic, that's formed the basis of what they're coming forward with in the new seasons. And the same with Lincoln Center. That's what's been, I think, and this has been a project, as you can imagine, has been pretty inspiring all the way along. But, you know, its objectives, its vision, what it wants to do, how it's raised money for it, but how it's done it in the service of an arts organization that is looking to connect with new audience and help shape these changes that our entire culture are looking to do. That's what's been pretty inspiring. And I think that's what, Deborah's absolutely right, knock on wood. None of this is guaranteed, but they've set in place, I think, the ability to help support these changes when we open in October and in the coming years.
Well, Adam, think of this, Aaron, think of this, that, you know, in the midst of what was happening, there was, you know, partnerships are complicated. We have two enormous organizations and iconic organizations, Lincoln Center and the New York Philharmonic. We have two architects. Two sets of architects who had very specific responsibility. we had to engage the community of New York to raise the money, but engage them in other ways. And, you know, hats off to the board of directors of Lincoln Center and the New York Philharmonic that they had, that we presented a vision and they had the courage to say, yes, this is the time, we've got to try it. And in fact, as we think about what will happen in the hall in the inaugural season, I mean, all of us, as we went through the pandemic, I believe, asked ourselves, have I changed? What did I learn? What's the meaning of my life now? We know about the Great Resignation, all of these things. And so that informed our planning of the season so that, in fact, we've divided the season into four different themes that run throughout it. One is called home. The other is liberation. Another one is called spirit. And the final is earth. But home, all of us experience not only, you know, what is the meaning of home as we were confined in the way that we were, but for us, there was a duality of message in that we are building a new home for the future. And in fact, the opening month of October will be an entire one-month festival called Home, which the first week of concerts will be entirely open and free to the public. Then there are all sorts of other explorations that happen. The murder of George Floyd rocked this nation, and of course, it's a dialogue that needs to continue. And so we are committed to an entire part of the season that discusses these kinds of issues seen through and created by Black artists and communities. Spirit. Think about, we all express spirituality in different ways. So in back-to-back weeks, we're performing two of, I think, the greatest works about spirituality, Bach's St. Matthew Passion, which is his deep pronunciation of his Lutheran faith, but juxtaposed against Olivier Messiaen's great work, Tarangalila, which is his own sort of ecstatic spirituality realized through nature, because he saw nature in God. And then there's a final pillar, we call these our pillars of the season, which is called Earth. And it's responding to the climate crisis that we all know is upon us. And you just saw the UN report that came out today, which is we are running out of time. This will open with a massive oratorio, multimedia oratorio, written by the great composer Julia Wolfe, in which she looks at climate change, but she starts looking at the original climate crisis, Noah bringing his animals onto the ark, and then moves forward from there. So it's all, we have so much great music we're performing, but also framed against, you know, an emotional and intellectual basis, because so many of us, I think, during the pandemic, moved from the cerebral to the emotional to the very practical. We have a whole series with the great world musician Chris Thiele, called the 65th Street Sessions, where he's bringing in all sorts of artists, not from the classical music world, but informed by the programs of the Philharmonic. They'll have all of the performances at the Sidewalk Studio. But this is the concept of music in our time and how it informs us in all sorts of ways. But if the audience doesn't come in, Gary, and have a great acoustic experience, a great improved audience experience, if they don't feel inspired, we won't have done our job. I think you have.
Well, Gary McCluskey, Deborah Borda, this has been an absolutely amazing conversation, and I can't wait for October to see the reception of it. So thank you all so much, and enjoy, everybody.
Thank you, Aaron.
We can't wait for October either. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to an episode of Designed, a podcast by Architectural Record. If you enjoyed this episode, we would appreciate you taking a moment to subscribe to the podcast, give us a rating, and leave us a comment. Have a wonderful day.